Hello, film fans. Welcome to the Film vs. Film podcast. My name is Martin Harries, your host, and I'm joined by the film encyclopedia man, Boaz Dix. We are a couple of filmmakers on occasion, but mainly can't stop yapping about movies. On this podcast, every episode we pick a topic from a film that's coming out at the cinema or on VOD. Myself and Boaz pick our favourite film from that topic, and we battle it out to decide which film will become the greatest film of all time, according to two film geeks from Wiltshire, England. If you enjoy this podcast, please leave us a review and subscribe. Hello, film fans. Welcome to the Film vs. Film podcast. As ever, I'm joined by Mr. Encyclopedia Man. How are you, sir, Mr. Boaz Dix?
I am exquisite and fantastic. Yeah.
Good, good. This week we'll be doing Jodie Foster films as The Maraturian comes out on VOD this week. So we'll have a look at Jodie Foster films. I'll go with my pick first. Well, first of all, one of us had to pick the obvious one. And when I asked Boaz this last week, I was like, so you know what the obvious Jodie Foster film is, right? And he's like, Contact? I'm like, no. Taxi Driver? No. It's the Silence of the Lambs. I'm just giving away your one, but
yeah, I guess I mainly kind of forget she was in it. I always think of Anthony Hopkins.
Really?
Hopkins or whatever.
I went with Contact because I just really admire the themes they try and go for in this film. Yeah, if Boaz didn't pick The Silence of the Lambs, I would have picked that. So, you know, but because he went first for once, I went for Contact. Should we go straight into it with directing?
Let's go straight into it. I would also like to make a sort of admission. I'm not going to let this colour my bias because I like these films, but I don't like Jodie Foster.
Oh, really?
No.
Oh,
okay. No, I don't like her. Not like a personal thing.
Oh, why is that?
It's not really a personal thing. There's something about her.
She just doesn't do it for you.
No, she doesn't do it for me. There's something about her face, her voice, they just irritate me.
Okay.
Yeah, it sounds really unfair.
I'm sensing some low scores.
No, I won't let it colour my judgment, but I don't know. She just annoys me. I can't stand
her. All right. Yeah. Let's do acting last. So directing, well, first of all, let's just do a quick synopsis of what this film is about. So this film follows Jodie Foster's character Ellie Arroway, a astrological radio scientist kind of thing. I don't know what the correct term is, but you see a
space
child first. Yeah. Her father dies and she pursues this career of trying to find extraterrestrial life in space by, you know, listening through radios to see if there's a signal or anything. And she basically gets lots of pushback from all these different characters, from, you know, especially people like Tom Selleck's character who plays Dr. Drummond, and all these male characters that are trying to suppress her in her goal and her career. And then one day she hears this really incredible pulsing noise that gives off all these prime numbers, and then the story goes from there, basically, and of this really incredible journey into outer space. Directing, then, you got any thoughts about Robert Zemeckis's camera work?
Oh yeah.
Or any particular scenes?
Yeah. I do like some of the shots, and a few of them I've seen compilations of and rewatched. You know, I've said this before, I really like transitions, and I like effective uses of transitions where you're like, whoa,
we should call you
just
the Mr. Transition Man now.
yeah, I know. I should only talk about transitions. But I just think, you know, they're one of the most interesting things to watch in a film. That, I mean, it may not actually directly impact the story, but it's just amazing. Like, say, the very first shot is a transition shot, but it's just so insane, the scope of it, because it's planets,
the
Earth.
Shot.
Zooming out, you know, the solar system, the galaxy, you know, galaxy clusters, the universe, and then it's her iris. It's her eye.
As a child.
I just love that. You know, I thought that was an amazing shot. It's a hell of a good shot to open a film on.
Yeah. That's my favourite shot, actually, in the film.
Yeah, it just blew my mind, and then they open it, yeah.
Because it goes in reverse of music and radio history,
yeah.
Right back to, you know, the 30s. They don't actually reveal the Olympic ceremony that Hitler gives in that moment, I don't think.
Well, I think you can hear, like, German, you hear, like, loads of signals. They're overlapping one another. So it's like, it's tons of noise, just radio. And as it goes further back, it's like less and less and less. You do hear Hitler and then Stacker.
Because obviously, the before you get to that shot, you have the title sequence all in silence. And I, you know, write notes on my phone. And there's no, like, fade into the sound effects and all the music and radio. And when that comes on, it made me jump, and I literally nearly, like, lobbed my phone across the room.
I thought there was something wrong with my speakers, you know, or my headphone. I thought I was like, what the hell's going on?
Yeah. I mean, that moment must have been incredible to hear in a cinema, you know.
Yeah.
If you got the chance to.
Yeah, no, that was a really good opening shot. There were other, like, really inventive shots I quite like, and transitions. Okay, I would say the one that is my favourite that I've watched many, many times in just clip form, but seeing it in the context of the film, is where her father collapses and she runs up the stairs to get to the cabinet, the bathroom cabinet, to get his medication. And how it's her running up the stairs, her running down the hallway, and then it's like, oh, no, that's a mirror reflection of her. That's her reflection in the glass, you know. I just thought that was a really clever shot. You don't see that much.
Did you notice the way the popcorn falls on the floor is like the star constellation she sees in her hand, in the sand, and, you know, when she actually gets to Vega?
It's the same pattern in the popcorn. No, I didn't know that. That's crazy.
When his dad dies. When her dad dies, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a hell of a coincidence. Otherwise, did he put the popcorns on the floor like that as a clue? Or, you know, did the aliens kill him and, like, leave their calling card? Probably not. It's probably a coincidence. No. Yeah.
I think it's just that whole storytelling device of, at the end, where, like, the alien in on Vega, like, basically, like, scans her memories or whatever and just gives her that sense of hope at the end when she sees the grains of sand, and that you see that pattern in her hand, you know, right at the end, which links to the line, you know, small steps, Ellie, small steps, you know, small moves, rather, small moves, which I thought was really clever. But Robert Zemeckis, again, like, has these incredible, great, flowing camera shots. There's so many efficiently shot scenes where there's a lot of conversations where the camera is, like, really far out, and then you slowly move in to the characters at the right opportune moment of meaning, you know, in the conversation, and it goes right into close-up, which I thought was just really clever, just... really great, efficient directing. One moment that I found quite funny, though, is when you see Jodie Foster for the first time as an adult, and you're like, hang on a minute, there are Alec Trevelyan's GoldenEye base from GoldenEye. Yeah. She's in trouble.
Yeah.
You know.
Sure, Sean Bean's behind her or something. So. Yeah.
They've rebuilt it. What's going on?
Bond! You're needed. Yeah. That would be a hell of
Jodie
a twist.
Foster's in trouble.
Yeah, or she's a supervillain. She's the one truly behind. Janos and all that. Yeah, when she goes through the wormhole and all that stuff, I mean, that was freaky as hell. It's just...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, really phonetic.
Yeah, I really like the special effects in that of the wormhole. I think it still stands up really well.
I think the wormhole stands up, but what's bizarre is where her pocket, her locket... starts floating. I didn't
the
like
compass.
That compass. I didn't like the look of that. I thought, hang on a minute, that looks a bit strange.
Yeah, so, that bit, I agree that the CGI on that isn't great.
Yeah. I think CGI for things that you've never seen before are easier than CGI for, like, mundane things. Like, actually going through the wormhole, I was like, whoa. Because I don't know what the hell a wormhole looks like. Maybe it looks like that. But yeah, the pocket watch or whatever the hell she had, the compass, that didn't look real to me.
But I did quite like that visual idea of, you know, when Ellie unstraps herself from the seat and like everything around her is vibrating apart from her and the compass. You know, that was quite a nice visual look there before she gets to Vega. But what I really didn't like, though, in that sequence is the CG on her face when she says the line, "They should have sent a poet."
Yeah.
And I'm just like, when she's looking at, like, I don't know, some galaxy, and she says, "They should have sent a poet." And I'm like, oh my God, what are they doing to her face? Like, because they CGI her face to make her look like the child version of her. I'm like, that just did not work for me at all.
Yeah.
It looked so bad.
Yeah. I didn't know. Like, I mean, she's already got a kind of freaky face anyway. So, you know, not to insult her too much. I don't want to make enemies of Jodie Foster. But yeah. Yeah, maybe it's an improvement.
Yeah, I just felt that point didn't work at all. I didn't. Yeah, it was just too weird for me.
Yeah, it's a bit weird. Yeah. Also, what was it? The camera work where it constantly focuses on that cult leader. I thought that was really effective because every time I was like, where the hell is this going? You know, whenever she looks at him, it's like literally, like that close to his face.
And stare downs.
Yeah, exactly. And he ends up being quite an important part of the plot.
Because obviously he sabotages the first test on the machine, which leads to Tom Selleck's death. Which I'm not too bothered that he died because he was a bit of a dick in the film.
He was a bit of a dick, yeah.
So I'm like, meh.
Yeah.
Carry on with the story.
He didn't believe in the program. He shut it down. And then when it succeeded, he's taken all the goddamn credit. And then he wants to be on the
little bastard.
Yeah, and then he wants to take her place on the flight, you know? It's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
He was a jackass, yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about Alan Silvestri's music, actually, because you just mentioned this the sabotage scene. Because again, like Robert Zemeckis does all these really great, you know, camera work, dynamic moves, and the acting's really great. But I think without the music that ties it all together, you're going to have quite a boring scene. There's another one when they first hear the pulsing. You know, and the shot goes right onto Jodie Foster's eyes when she hears the pulse when she's just lying on a car. And with that scene as well, like, all you have is just Jodie Foster, like, screaming down the radio and her driving down the road past all the dishes in New Mexico, and you've just got two guys, you know, just messing around with two monitors. And yet, though, both of those scenes are, like, really compelling, and yet, you know, without the music, I think those two scenes would seem pretty dull. You know, I just think sometimes when the scene doesn't quite work, even though you have great acting and great directing and it still doesn't work, you need like great music to like tie everything together to make the scene work. And I think the music's just tremendous from Alan Silvestri, who does the Avengers films as well. So,
yeah, no, it is good. It does. It definitely does accentuate the film. It like makes it a lot more compelling, and so it's just like unique uses of transition shots I quite like, or any kind of unique shot, and Robert Zemeckis does seem to like, you know, pushing it with the like unique shots. But where it kind of goes from her talking to that billionaire, you know, in his private John Hurt. And I just loved how when he's talking and it fades into her talking to another room of scientists, where he's, you know, he's like explaining, like what the
want to take a ride?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but when he's like explaining what the messages mean, that they're in fact instructions how to build something, and it goes from explaining to her explaining. I like that.
Okay, what score would you give directing?
I'd probably give it like a 9.
A 9. Oh, yeah. Okay. That's pretty high.
I'm always pretty high. I'm always high.
I don't think I would go as high as that. I think because we covered Castaway, another Robert Zemeckis film, on last week's episode. And I think for me that is better directed than this one.
Yeah.
For me.
Although I scored pretty high. I think I scored... How much did I score for that one? I must have scored like tons.
You scored 8.6 for Castaway.
Oh, okay. In that case,
8.7.
In that case, 8.5 then. I'll change my mind.
Okay.
Be more consistent.
I'm going to go probably 8.4 then, because I do quite like the fact that Zemeckis recognizes that well, for me anyway, that the value in Alan Silvestri's music is really powerful in this film. For all Zemeckis' flair with the camera, you still need that added oomph and drive with the music to make these scenes work really well. And I think it definitely achieves that. But the CGI thing with with Jodie Foster looking like her as a child in the capsule at the end just did not work for me at all, and I don't understand why they put that in. For me, the strongest element of this film is definitely the script and the acting as well. So I would probably go 8.4. Yeah. So should we go straight into screenplay?
Yeah.
I have many thoughts. I really find like Matthew McConaughey's character really interesting in this film because he's a very complicated character, and you don't see characters like Dr. Palmer Joss in this in cinema really of this, you know, religious type that likes science but just doesn't want science to be abused to obscure truth, you know. And one great line that you kind of get across really well with his characters when he says, when he meets Dr. Arroway Ellie for the first time, he kind of says, oh, you can call me a man of the cloth but without the cloth, you know. Yeah. You know, I thought it was quite a clever way to just to ease you into this.
I bet a lot of girls want him to take all those cloths off.
Yeah, probably, but I think Matthew McConaughey is really incredible in this film. For me, the film deals with like gender equality issues as well, because literally every time like Ellie discovers like a new discovery and is trying to explain the situation to the powers that be, Dr. Drumlin literally always interrupts her and finishing off her point as if, you know, and takes the credit for what Ellie is trying to do.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, in some ways, he's only really doing that because he knows that the powers that be will only actually listen to Dr. Drumlin, not Dr. Arroway, Jodie Foster's character. And it's just like, you just have this sense of really of frustration for Jodie Foster's character, Ellie, throughout the whole film, really, until the end. Well, pretty much all the way till the end, there's frustration there and for her, you know. But I mean, what do you think about like what this film is trying to say? Because it's really interesting, and I think it's really interesting actually watching this film today with how, you know, truth is really just being challenged a lot in like social media today. Because this film is all about like with relationships, with strong relationships, if someone says something really outlandish and crazy, but because the relationship is so strong, you believe them. You believe they are telling the truth. And this film kind of explores that type of ideology, you know, at the end, which they deal with in with these two characters, Arroway and Dr. Joss, Matthew McConaughey's character. And the film is kind of summed up really well, like halfway through at the reception, you know, at this party scene. And Ellie and Palmer go out on the balcony and, you know, they're talking about science and God and all that. And Ellie says, for me, I'd need proof that God exists. But then Palmer asks, proof? Did you love your father? And then Ellie says, yes, of course, very much. And then Palmer asks again, prove it. Prove to me that you love your father. Mm. Of course, that she... there's no way she can prove that she loves her father. And it's just that whole thing of sometimes to seek truth from anything or anyone, you have to believe in them, you know? Mm. And I just find that a really incredible ideology that this film explores. And it couldn't be more important like today for me with the whole thing of truth being just so muddled today. I mean, a prime example is like this whole the group of flat earthers that they are adamant that the earth is flat, and everyone else is just like, what the fuck is what are you on about? The earth is round. People went into a fucking rocket and looked out the window. The earth is round.
That's what the NSA would have you believe. They were in Texas. Nothing. They never went anywhere. No, I'm joking. Yeah, no, I get you. No, I would say, like, yeah, the theme of the film is about truth, and it's about faith and stuff like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's about belief. You know, it very much doesn't hide that. It wears that on its sleeve. You know, I would say, you know, going deeper into it, I don't think that there's a particular problem of truth nowadays. There always has been. Nobody has ever agreed, ever. Yeah. You know, I find it kind of hilarious that as a species, and I think the film very much makes every character do this, everybody wants the truth, but nobody agrees on what the hell is actual evidence. And it's all very complicated and very difficult, you know. I think that's basically what the film shows. Getting the truth is difficult, and sometimes,
the truth is difficult because when someone you don't know, you know, is saying, oh, this and this and this is the truth, the other person's like, well, prove it to me. Yeah. I need some fucking evidence, please.
Well, I think, you know, there's a kind of irony because she's, you know, and the film is very acknowledgeable of that fact, that she is very much against ideas of, like, based on faith. She's a person of reason and science. Yeah. She doesn't believe in God and anything else, you know. It needs to be proven. And she has this fascination with space, and she wants to know if there's, you know, life beyond the stars. And at the end, from her perspective, she literally does go to a different, you know, solar system. She's in Vega, She talks with aliens who, like, you know, look like a dad, and it's all really, you know, pretty crazy. And from their perspective, she literally just fell. You know, her shuttle, it failed, and it just fell into the sea. And they're just like, prove it. And it's kind of funny that at the end they're like, so are you saying we have to take this on faith? And it's like, and you're like, oh my goodness. She's kind
because
of...
Because the shoe is on the other foot.
The shoe is on the other foot,
In the court hearing at the end. Because obviously during the selection process, they don't want to... Matthew McConaughey just couldn't bring himself to select Dr. Arroway Ellie to go on the mission because... as they say in the film, like 95% of the world population believes in God. Mm. And he couldn't bring himself to choose someone that doesn't believe in God, you know?
Yeah.
But then at the end, it's all the other way around. Yeah. She's like, no, please believe me that this is actually what happened, you know, but she can't prove it.
Yeah.
But at the very end, before, when Arroway and Palmer Joss are walking down the steps of the Capitol, which literally couldn't be more relevant today with historical events in America. He says, a reporter asks him, Dr. Joss, what do you believe? And he says, as a person of faith, I am bound by a different covenant than Dr. Arroway, but our goal is one and the same, the pursuit of truth. I, for one, believe her, you know, and it's just because their relationship is quite strong in the film. He believes her, you know. Mm. He believes that even though there is not one shred of evidence, she went to another world in Vega and saw other beings, you know.
I kind of find it funny from a script writing point of view. I love how they kind of constantly address it, and I suppose it just shows the lunacy of mankind. But I love it where the first message they get is from, you know, they get a recording sent back to them, and they're like, oh, you know, enhance it, turn it around. Does anybody speak German? And it's like Adolf Hitler. And I love it how she goes around the site. She goes back to work and there are people setting up camp like, aliens, come, please, we love you. And Christian's like, no, this is demonic. There's a cult for aliens. But there are loads of neo-Nazis.
Elvis.
Yeah, there's an Elvis. But I found it funny that there were all these neo-Nazis that are like, yeah, this is a sign from this is a sign from Hitler. This is like...
Because if there was neo-Nazis there, they would literally try and beat everyone up.
Yeah, exactly.
And kill everyone.
Yeah. But I just find it really funny. It was like the neo-Nazis are like, this proves
like
that,
having a party with everyone
exactly.
else.
Exactly. The aliens are Nazis. Hitler's maybe an alien. I don't know. But it was... it's kind of funny.
That didn't particularly run true.
Oh, I think it runs... I think it runs true. People are fucking stupid.
Have neo-Nazis at like a festival, they're going to fucking try and kill
everyone.
No, they
won't, because we've had neo-Nazis even during the... whole what was it, Trump thing. There was a huge support of neo-Nazis. Like almost none of those things turned violent, you know, because a neo-Nazi would get arrested, you know. So it's like you can can start shouting, yeah, we ought to kill X, Y, and Z, but you can't say let's kill X, Y, and Z, and you can't actually kill someone. Like as stupid as a Nazi is, they're not stupid enough to throw themselves in jail, you know. But yeah.
But I thought, I guess it wasn't riotous enough for me, I guess.
I think there would be a lot more riots. I think cities would be on fire if we learned that like aliens were 100% true. Yeah, yeah, I 100% believe that, you know. People are irrational and yeah, I would expect a lot more broken windows, you know. Well, I mean, shit, you got an exploded... I suppose they got halfway in that house, you know, in a more dramatic way, where the guy blew up the space station because, you know, he believed the aliens were like gods or whatever. So, yeah, that's the kind of shit you'd see on a daily basis. You know, I may sound like a complete a cynic, but yeah, I think humans are awful, awful creatures. We are terrible.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, a lot of the great science fiction writers have that same belief, like Philip K. Dick, like, hates humanity, and Stanley Kubrick just hates people in general.
Yeah, man.
You know, people like that, so it's nothing new there.
Exactly. I hope there are no humans listening to this channel. That would be terrible. They know what I actually think of them. But, yeah.
But I really like the storytelling when Ellie actually meets the alien on Vega, because everything is like made comfortable for her. You know, the alien looks like her dad and the setting is of a beach that refers back to the drawing she does as a child with her dad, you know, that he shows her dad the drawing of the beach. And what I love as well is that Ellie asks about like the transit system, you know, the wormhole, and he says, oh, we didn't build it. We don't know who did.
Mm.
And it's just like, whoa.
Yeah, I know.
There must have been even you know, more powerful civilization than them, you know, millions of years before, you know. It's just makes the universe in this story seem even bigger.
Yeah.
I just really like that.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of unrelated, but sort of scary. Did you hear about that guy who worked for, I can't remember what nation's space program it was. It was like Australia or Israel or one of these countries. And he just flat out said a few months ago, do you remember this? It never made the news. It never made the news. I'm not even sure if it's real. Could be like just made up. But he just flat out said, yeah, there are aliens. He's like, yeah, we were contacted by aliens.
Who's that? Sorry,
I have no idea. Like what his name was. It was so crazy.
Okay.
I won't talk about it here and freak out listeners and stuff. I'll find the Facebook article.
I'll cut this out then.
Yeah, cut it out. Cut it out. Cut it out. We don't want people hanging themselves. or do we? I don't know. It would sort out the human problem. I don't know. But
oh my god,
this has gotten really dark. Oh. Sorry,
Boaz is disguised as Thanos today.
I'm starting to turn purple. Yeah,
maybe I will keep it.
maybe keep it in. I don't know. But yeah, I won't disclose that information here. But I'll Facebook it.
All right. Have you got a favorite line?
Oh yeah, actually, it's just because it was funny. I suppose there are a lot of serious lines. There's a lot of dramatic stuff, you know, there's quite a lot of serious stuff. But one of the things I just it stuck in my head and I thought was funny is, you know, James Woods. Yeah, he's in this. Yeah. He's in this film. And I love that line where, you know, they get the message from Hitler and the vice president or whatever, the woman there. Mm-hmm. She's like, 20 million people it took to kill that son of a bitch, and you know, and he's our first ambassador, and he's like, why would they send it to us? And like James Woods is like, maybe that's their intentions, you know, maybe it's like, oh, what was it, he said something that was really funny, maybe it's like Sig Heil, you know, we agree with you or something like that, you know, we're on your team, like they're space Nazis. And I thought that was funny.
My favorite line involves James Woods' character, Kitts, as well. When they're just about to see Jodie Foster go into the machine in the second launch. William Fincher's character, Kent, who plays the blind guy, McConaughey like brings him in, and then he walks past Kitts and he says, "Oh, nice to smell you again, Mr. Kitts." wouldn't take him as a polo man. Which is quite funny. Yeah. That made me chuckle.
Yeah.
So screenplay score for you, Mr. Encyclopedia Man.
Yeah. I think maybe I'll give it like a 8.7.
Cool. Yeah, I'm really impressed with this script. You don't see many science fiction films that deal with like faith and science in this way. It's usually just science and science, you know, and a bit more science.
Yeah, it seems very fiction. like what was it? You get it from a point of view of there's a scientist, and it's more science fiction, and it's more like everybody's on the same playing field. Everybody's like,
yeah, but it's more like survival horror kind of.
But it's like in real life, if something like this happened, yeah, it would be like, who's going to contact this thing? I like that they even went into that. Should it be an American? Why should it be an American? You know, why not a this? And you've got other countries like selling their bids to send a man to space in exchange for some contract or whatever. And you think that it's just very real, like the politics of it. And yeah, of course, religious people would want to talk to it, you know, or have an opinion about it. It's like, yeah, we're not all one voice. And like millions of us would be like, I want to do this. We want to do that. So I do kind of like that realism in the script, that it does feel like it's the world being contacted rather than, you know, the United States or whatever, or NASA. Yeah.
It's interesting, actually, because obviously Castaway came after this film. And as I spoke last time, he doesn't really deal with the media and the world's perception of Tom Hanks's character
film,
where he does, he goes full throttle really in the media and the world perception in this film. So it's just really interesting to see why he kind of ignores that angle in Castaway. So
I think maybe I'm not gonna be in his head, and obviously, you know, the directors are not screenwriters, so I don't know who did the screenplay. But yeah, it seems far more, it's public and personal in this film, but it's just personal in Castaway. It's just about Tom Hanks.
Yeah, Michael Goldenberg and James V. Hart wrote it. So I'll probably go with a 9.2, I reckon, for screenplay.
That's pretty good.
I was just really impressed how they married these two themes. I was just really impressed. Right, acting. What do you got?
Again, I don't want to bitch about it too much. I don't know what it is about Jodie Foster. I just she just doesn't do
harsh.
It for me. Yeah, I know. It's really harsh. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm not sure what it is. Is it she breathes too heavily? I just can't really like stand looking at her on a film. This is very Jodie Foster.
I think she's great.
She's good.
I think there's a great moment from her when she's at the presentation of these business executives, which obviously work for the John Hurt character. And, you know, she does her normal presentation she normally would, and she can tell she's just not engaging that well with the guys across from her in this, like, massive curved desk, which looks ridiculous. And then she's just like, fuck it. And then just does this really desperate and passionate speech about...
Yeah, it sounds crazy. Right? You know, so does sending a man into this, you know... On a plane, that sounds crazy.
A man trying to fly or send a man to the moon and stuff. Yeah. And then she just ends by saying, "This could be the most impactful moment for the history of history." You know, and I think she just balances her passion with desperation really well, because I think in her mind, she's certainly thinking, "Well, I'm going to get a no anyway, so I might as well just throw the kitchen sink at this."
Exactly.
But then she does get a yes, and it's just... her expression is with just sheer delight and joy, and just smiles and says thank you to the camera watching her. It's quite a cool moment from Foster. Yeah, what do you think about Bill Clinton in this being spliced into the film as the president?
Yeah, I mean, you know,
that was a bit weird.
It is a bit weird. I think it's trying to add that extra layer of realism, like it's something that's going to occur very soon. And yeah, I kind of get that. I suppose that makes sense without actually hiring another actor. I think they've done that in a more recent film. I can't remember what it was, where I saw Obama in it. Like, it might have been one of the Transformer movies or something. And, like, Obama was in it. And I was like, what the fuck? So, you know.
Yeah. I think it was they wanted to get Sidney Poitier as the president, and he turned it down, like, really late on in the day. So, I'm like, oh, shit, what are we going to do?
We'll get the actual president. Like, my God. Was he not busy? Isn't he, like, meant to, like, run the free world or whatever? You know, has he not got nothing to do?
Well, no, he didn't act in it. It's spliced real footage.
Oh, okay.
No, he didn't. Oh. Did you think he was actually acting?
I thought they actually got him. All right.
No.
All right. Shows how slow I am.
It's just spliced media footage into the film.
Ah, fair enough. Okay.
Oh, dear.
Shut up.
But yeah, but at the same time, I'm just like, hello. Morgan Freeman is just like in the wings, just waiting. Hello, I can do it.
Exactly.
I'm a really good president. Yeah. He's basically Hollywood's president.
He is. And Hollywood's God. Freeman. He's the president, God, the narrator. Yeah.
Yeah.
He can be everything.
And then there's a moment in the film that turns like really mysterious. You have a very mysterious vibe when John Hurt's character turns up. And he's very much this eccentric, like Elon Musk type figure. And you can really tell like John Hurt is like really enjoying himself in this, in those incredible glasses. I'm like, oh my God, how does he wear those?
Yeah.
What do you think about John Hurt in this film?
Oh yeah, John Hurt was really cool. Yeah. Very eccentric, very funny.
It was pretty sad when he died.
It is, actually. Especially when... because he isn't there to defend himself. He dies during the inquiry against her, where they're thinking that this is all bullcrap. They're like, well, she's like, well, what about the, you know, the message from space and the blueprints how to make this? He goes, well, what would you need to fake that message? Well, you'd need a satellite, you'd need this, you'd need that. All the stuff that John Hurt has. And it's like, yeah, maybe he just took you for a wild, he took the whole world for a wild ride. And then he's dead. So he can't say, like, no, I didn't.
Yeah, he
Elon Musk. He played cool. Elon Musk, yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, basically. Old Elon Musk.
One scene that really, like, reinforces the connection and the relationship between Jodie Foster's character, Haraway, and Matthew McConaughey's character, Joss, is when all the main players of power are sat in a meeting, and Ellie is like, going through these blueprints to them. And she thinks it could be like a transportation device. And everyone's like, really? And thinks it could be like a really dangerous weapon of some kind. And then like McConaughey comes in late and he's obviously explaining like the religious angle on this and not really agreeing with Ellie at all, but he's smiling at her. And just to say, it's like, it's really nice to see you again. Because obviously at that point, we haven't seen McConaughey's character for a while. Because this is quite a long film, like 2 hours, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And then Ellie is kind of like, looks kind of confused about why is he smiling at me? And it's, and then she's just like, she smiles back. And it's just this whole really cute moment of just these two. It's just a nice moment of them seeing each other again. You know, it's really, really nice.
Yeah.
And again, like McConaughey is amazing when he meets Ellie after the selection process, the interview, and he says, like, our job was to select somebody to speak for everyone. I just couldn't be in good conscience vote for a person who doesn't believe in God. And you can tell he's kind of like fighting back the emotions because he's really fond of her and he can't go back on his beliefs. And Foster is great in that as well, just like sticking to her scientific beliefs. Yeah. And she says like Drummond is basically just saying what
they
the committee
wanted
to hear, you know. But what slightly annoyed me as well is that, like, just before Jodie goes back in, you know, goes into the John Hurt's machine, like, he comes in to meet her and, like, gives her the compass and is like, oh, I lied before. I only didn't want you to go.
Because I didn't want to lose you. Yeah,
I didn't want to lose you. And it's just like, oh, really? You didn't need to say that? Because I think you just see all that in his acting anyway. Yeah. I'm not necessarily think you need to reinforce that meaning with that line.
It's a really kind of cliche... line. You hear that all the time.
Yeah.
It's like in so many romantic films. It's like, oh, I didn't mean what I said. I only did it. So, yeah. It's like, yeah, I think
it just
right.
undermines his whole philosophy a little bit. Yeah. And it's just like, oh, you don't, I'm not sure you need that, you know. Yeah. But again, Hollywood film, got to have something like that in there. Any other performances that you liked?
You know, that vice president girl, she's sassy. Yeah.
Oh, Angela Bassett.
Yeah, she was really sassy. Quite like that.
Angela Bassett is awesome.
Yeah, she's really good. Yeah.
Black Panther's mum, gotta love her.
Oh yeah. You know, she speaks with quite a lot of authority. You know, you're like, whoa.
Yeah, she's brilliant.
Yeah, she's pretty good.
Who's your favorite?
I would say Matthew McConaughey. Matthew McConaughey was my favorite. Yeah.
I think probably his last great performance before the reconnaissance, possibly. Yeah.
I love that. I love that term, the reconnaissance. That's just crazy.
All right. I love the fact that he knows that that's a thing. Yeah. You know, when he accepted his Oscar, you know, he says that, and it's like, oh, yeah. That was funny.
Yeah.
But I think I'm going to go with Jodie Foster. I think she, you know, pretty much every single scene she is in, and she carries the film. And when you've got, certainly there's all this power pushback on her career and her theories about what's actually going on. And, you know, she's always got so many conflicts all around her, and just to keep that performance going and is pretty incredible, I think. Yeah. And make it seem really convincing. So what's your score for acting?
I'm going to give it a 8.5.
The three standouts for me are obviously Jodie Foster, Matthew McConaughey, and John Hurt. Mm. I think everyone else is good, but again, like, it's a big cast, and
I think they're not the central focus, and they don't have like a lot to do, but they are good.
But I think for me, you know, the best aspect by far is the screenplay for me, and the two characters that obviously work that screenplay the best is and have the best lines are, you know, Foster and McConaughey, and John Hurt has all the funny ones as well and the epic lines.
Yeah.
So I'll probably go like a solid 8.5 as well, I reckon. So let's add up the scores then for Contact. Mm. So Contact gets 51.8, wow. Which is pretty good.
That's pretty good.
Right, let's move on then to Boaz's pick, which we already know about, which is...
Silence of the Lambs. Yes, Clarice.
Yeah, this film is like endlessly quotable. Oh, I fucking love this film so much. Anthony Hopkins is one of my favourite actors of all time. I just adore his performance in this. Yeah. Some people say it is a bit too theatrical compared to like Brian Cox's version in Manhunter. Yeah. But I just think this...
Well, it stands out.
A lot better.
Yeah, definitely. It stands out. If you were to think of any kind of television serial killer, you're going to think of Hannibal Lecter, and you're going to think of Anthony Hopkins' performance.
Directing then for Silence of the Lambs, I think... We're probably going to be mainly talking about the scene where, you know, Jodie Foster's character meets Hannibal Lecter for the first time in his glass cell. Mm. But certainly the directing in that from Jonathan Demme is really, really great. The suspense building is really, really cool, where the camera just tracks Foster in front of her. And it's cut with like POV shots of glimpses of all the inmates in the cells, and you go past Miggs, you know, who's just looks really crazy and an absolute nutter. And then when Hannibal Lecter is that
I could smell your guy.
Yes, now I've got a sense of that bit. I was clearly trying to avoid that line, but there we go.
I've always got to ruin everything. I make it better.
Okay, where was I? Yeah, and then when...
You were at... I can smell you. No, I'm joking.
And there's another one. When Hannibal Lecter is revealed, he's like standing like dead center of his cell, like completely still, you know, and just really polite. You know, it's just incredible opening shot of Anthony Hopkins as Lecter. Any other directing bits you liked in this film?
Tons. I would actually start like from the beginning. I try and work, you know, I'll work that way. But even like the opening of her doing the obstacle course, like tracking her to do that. Like the first time you see her, she's going uphill in an obstacle course, you know, hiking her way up. And it's just it kind of gets you into a sort of look at her character, like straight off the bat. Very hardworking, very determined. She's struggling, but she's pushing through it. She's got a tremendous amount of willpower. You know, she's very good at her studies, and it's just that's what you get of her. Yeah, but this case is absolutely nuts. So other things I like in directing, you know, when you first meet Hannibal Lecter, just amazing. But also like the suspense up until meeting him, like, you know, where you see his doctor, who's really creepy and stuff, and walks her down, and it's like into a basement. It's lower and lower and lower.
Such a creep.
He is so weird. Yeah, I think he's creepier than Hannibal Lecter. Like, he is. He seems perverse. You know, he really likes her.
Yeah.
I found it funny where he's like smiling at her when he's like, "Don't touch the glass." He goes, "He's very tricky, you know, and all this stuff. But don't listen to anything he says." And gives her a picture, and is like, what was it? He was complaining of chest pain, so we had to undo his muzzle and have a look at him. And he grabbed the nurse, and he's like, this is what was left of her. We managed,
the picture, do you?
Yeah, no, she's like, what the hell? But how he's just smiling of like, you know, his pulse never raised even as he ate her tongue. And he's just like, it's really creepy.
His pulse never went above 65 or something like that.
Yeah.
85.
Yeah, yeah, that was really interesting. And like how the camera is like really on his face. It's like getting a twisted satisfaction of it. And yeah, you do expect like Hannibal Lecter to be some sort of chainsaw wielding fucking lunatic. And he is kind of, he is pretty insane, but he looks like just kind of a harmless older man. He's just kind of like more, not physically intimidating, but just kind of creepy.
Paul Thomas Anderson has always referenced Jonathan Demme's directing in terms of his close-ups. He always like admires his close-ups, and he's always said like he's tried it like so many times, but he just can't get like the Jonathan Demme close-up ever in his films. Mm. Those close-ups of him in his films are incredible. From, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson saying that about Demme's close-ups is pretty cool. Yeah, and there's one close-up where, which is my favourite shot, actually. The close-up of Hopkins when he's in the cage. I can't think of, like, a more menacing shot on an actor than that one. Do you know the one I mean? Mm, yeah. Like, it's just, like, really close on his face. His face is, like, tilted forward. His eyes are, like, dead straight. That the lighting's so hard on him. And it's just an incredible close-up, you know, as he's asking question after question about Clarice's experience with the lamb, you know. Mm. It's just pretty incredible, that bit. There's also great moments of Lecter in before he gets transferred. He's still in, you know, the glass cell, and he's kind of like covered in shadow, and all you see is just his arms like resting on his knee. And then he says like, oh, I think I couldn't quite hear it, but he says, oh, you're bleeding for a start. And like, how the hell did you know Jodie Foster was bleeding? Because you cut herself in the yourself garage.
Yeah.
You know, there's no possible way he could have seen the cut, but he smells it.
He's basically a shark.
He's a cannibal.
He's a cannibal. Well, I love it when she first meets him and he says, like, what did Mig say to you? And I won't repeat the line. I've learned from that mistake. But he's like, I however cannot, but what I do smell. And he takes a sniff through the little air holes.
Oh,
and it's like
Evian skin cream.
Yeah.
But and then some perfume.
Yeah, you wear a perfume every day, but not today. Yeah, I thought that was great. Yeah, like, what the hell?
Yeah, his performance is incredible.
Yeah, it'd be funny if she was like, no, you are completely wrong. I don't use any of that stuff. Your analysis is terrible. But he's an amazing man.
Again, there's like more like gender equality issues in this film, which Silence of the Lambs and Contact deal with in, I think, probably a little bit better in this film, where, you know, there's the scene at the funeral for one of the Buffalo Bills victims, and Crawford doesn't want to discuss like the sex crime in front of Sterling, Jodie Foster's character, and he wants to talk to like the officer there in private, and then you just see all these cops just staring at her, and like the close up is just held on Foster's character for like too long, that's comfortable, and you can just kind of really feel all these eyes on her, and she just slowly like turns away, and you go into the flashback scene of her own father's death, and then it kind of like snaps her out of it with the sound effects of the present, and it's just really well directed and really played out and acted, just a great scene. And then you get that sense right from the start that she's, you know, a woman in a very male dominated world in this case, especially, and in the FBI, when she, you know, as you said, when she's doing that training sequence, when she gets called in to the FBI headquarters, she goes into the elevator and she's just surrounded by all these tall men as the elevator door closes. You know, there's another example there of just her in this, you know, male dominated world, and you're just like, how the hell is she going to survive this film? And one of my favorite scenes is actually when Lecter escapes in the ambulance, and he's just sitting there on the
that was grim.
And he just slowly like takes the mask off or whatever, sits.
It's
up,
not a mask.
Takes the skin.
Yeah, it takes the skin.
The air mask. And then takes the skin mask of one of the cops off, and you're like, and then it cuts. You know,
well, he kind of breathes like, like that behind that guy.
Yeah.
Could you imagine being that guy? Just like, shit.
And I defy anyone that saw that coming. No. I did not see that coming the first time.
So freaky.
It's incredibly dark twist in the storytelling.
Yeah. Well, you remember, because I love how, well, you know, you see him and he's breathing and he's like wriggling and stuff, and they're like getting him out of here and, you know, tell him it's going to be all right. That's Hannibal, you know. It's just, it makes the scene like so insane when you know. And when they find him in the elevator, what they think is him, they shoot him and he doesn't move.
And then shoot him in the leg.
And then like opens the hatch and he drops. And I love, he drops away from the camera, like his face is the other way. And then it's like, oh, we've got a problem. And then you see him in the ambulance. Like, that was insane. It's pretty crazy.
It felt to me, though, that it took a while for them to get to that conclusion that it wasn't him. I'm just like, come on, guys.
Well, what was it? Anyway. It was pretty disturbing.
Generally, this film is really dark. I mean, we'll get to it in the script, I guess, but
some of the dialogue is
so, like, disgusting and vile that comes out of Lecter's mouth, and it's just like, oh my god.
Well,
I remember there was a story recently actually that came out that Michelle Pfeiffer was actually offered the part of Agent Starling, and she turned it down because it was just like, it's just too evil for me. It's too much. Because obviously at that time she was a big star, you know. She's coming off the back of Batman Returns, possibly. I don't know if that was after or before, but she was, you know, a big star at the time. To turn that down was... She obviously regrets it now.
Well, her career's doing fine. Oh, I love the reveal shot with the moth. Like, you know all of this. You know the moth, you know who Buffalo Bill is, you know all that. And I love how when she actually goes to see him and doesn't know it's him, and sees all this sewing work around him, you know. We know he's making a dress, and you see the moth like that,
come down, and then in the background there's a picture of like butterflies. Did you notice that?
No, I didn't.
You know,
no,
she's walking through. What did you think about the the climax, if you will, when everything goes dark and he quickly goes, gets the gun, and he puts the night vision on? I mean, that scene was just terrifying.
That was a really good scene. Especially, he's like getting out his hand, he's toying with her, like trying to touch her hair.
The first time I saw that, I mean, I saw a shit ton of horror films when I was far too young. This one of them, but it's interesting.
And it didn't affect you at all.
I listened to the Empire Nope.
No, that's what you tell your victims.
Yeah, I'm slowly getting through cleaning all my bloody knives at the moment. And me sewing kit.
I wouldn't like to see your clothes wardrobe. Oh, my God. What should I wear today?
I'll just move the camera a little bit and you can see it.
Oh, man, that's horrible.
No, but I listened to the Empire podcast a lot, and they had a Celebration of Cinema episode, a special with Edgar Wright and Quentin Tarantino. It's like a good 3 hours long. It's incredible listening. But one thing they get onto the Silence of the Lambs, and Tarantino was saying that in that last scene, because you're so scared for Foster that there's a sense that she could die in this moment. But Tarantino disagreed. He was like, I've seen too many movies to think in this moment, at this point in time in the film, that Foster's character was going to die, you know. But in his film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, he was saying when Cliff Booth walks into... Have you seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Not yet. I need to get on with that.
All right. Yeah. Well, you don't care about spoilers, so yeah, I'll carry on. He walks into Spawn Ranch, and it's just a really, like, terrifying scene. Like, literally, like, two-thirds of the way through the film, he goes through this, like a haunted house situation. He doesn't die, but Tarantino was saying you get the sense that Cliff Booth could die in this film because he's not like the lead, and you're kind of only two-thirds halfway through the film. It's possible he could die, and it's pure terror in that moment. And Tarantino was saying at the end of Silence of the Lambs, because you're so far into the film, he was not convinced that she was ever going to die in that situation, even though the directing is so powerful and so suspenseful that, you know, she could do, but for Tarantino, it was like, nah, not going to happen. What do you think in that scene? Did you ever get the sense that Agent Sterling was going to die at the end?
I think maybe I do agree with Tarantino of it, you know, like, yeah, I mean, she's the hero and she's made it this far. But I think you do forget all that when you're in the moment. You forget all the tropes when you're in the moment of a film. So, yeah, you can go, yeah. Yeah, she definitely could die, and he could kill her very easily. And, you know, it's but for...
Certainly when the first time I saw it, yes, I was quite young, but I definitely was very much in it and fucking terrified for her, you know, that she could die. You know, it's just the fact that, Lecter dispatches those two cops with such ease, you know, earlier on in the film.
I thought even the whole setup to that, because where the captive, she's got his dog... And I love how all that's done, because she throws the bone up there and the thing gets the bone and she tries to yank it, but just the bone comes down and she's bursting into tears. And the dog just, you see a shot just from up inside the well from her point of view, and the dog comes back.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like, oh, are you crying? And then she, you know, she takes the dog and, you know, she's threatening it, and Buffalo Bill is going nuts. Lencher is giving them a tip on where he is. And he's like in some state really far away from where Clarice is. And I just love how his doorbell is ringing. You have the alarm on in his basement. And the cops, the SWAT team, like pressing the bell. And you're like, yeah, it's the same place.
Because it's all intercut, isn't it?
Yeah, with it's all cut.
Bill being really pissed off at Catherine in the well that she's nicked his dog and... You know, and all the FBI surrounding the building that you think is Buffalo Bill's house. But then when he opens the door, it's Agent Sterling, and you're like, oh, crap!
Yeah.
And it's such a surprising moment, because up until that point, like, the last dramatic moment was when Lecter escapes the cage in the, you know, in the airport. And then after that, there's like 20 minutes of not much going on, of not much tension building, and it's just... quite a shocking moment. They're like, oh shit, all of a sudden Agent Sterling is in massive danger.
Yeah,
you know, it's really well done.
Yeah,
from Demi there.
Yeah, definitely.
But also, going back to the final sequence after seeing the film many times, there's a moment where, like, well, yeah, just before the lights go out, you see this dead body in a bath of just, like,
yeah,
all
that was
this
gross.
Disgusting gunk. Yeah. It just looks horrible. And then now I'm just like, I don't care what the hell happens, just do not fall in the fucking bath, please.
I don't think that's how she died. I don't think she was having a bath, tripped on the soap, died, and he was like, well, I better make a skin out of this woman.
No.
Yeah.
But I'm just like, I don't care if you get killed, but just do not fall in the bath. Yeah. That is fucking disgusting.
It is pretty gross, yeah. You can tell she's been in there a long time. Like, the bath, she's bloated and the bath is filled with, like, it's dirty. It's skin and stuff. It's horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So have you got a favourite shot?
When Hannibal escapes, I think that's up there. And, you know, as you said, the him taking a face off of his face. I mean, that's got to be the most insane thing I've ever seen Anthony Hopkins do, you know? definitely. And, you know, I've seen him be like Odin, you know, I mean, that's pretty weird. And like fight a Transformer. But like, peeling a face off of his face. Good God. Yeah. I would say that's definitely up there. It's probably my best shot.
So directing score, I'm going to go pretty high. I think Jonathan Demme does an incredible job in this film. I mean, the close-ups alone are just some of the best close-ups in cinema on actors. Especially on Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go like 9.3, I think.
Yeah. I love how a lot of the shots, you know, especially when you're with Anthony Hopkins, really display his intellect, like how smart he is. Like, for example, like when he's being held down and stuff, and he's being told by the doctor that Sterling's offer of like a beach resort for him and all that was absolute crap. And you can tell he's pissed. And I just love how his eyes are darting to anything he can use to escape. Like, there's a pen. He's left a pen there. It's not even, you know, it's something there, you know. And I love that. And even, like, how he escapes is he uses the paperclip off of her file. You know, she, it's insane. But there's build-up to it. And, just the camera makes him appear smart. You know what he's looking at. You know what he's analysing.
Yeah, so score for directing?
Yeah, I would go fairly high, maybe 9.2.
All right, screenplay then. Again, as we said, you know, this film is endlessly quotable. I mean, the one that always I'm always remembering and quote sometimes is, a census tried to test me once. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
Yeah, I got to do that, yeah.
That's the one line I just always remember. I don't really get wrong. So.
Do you remember that scene?
Yes, there is something wrong with me.
Do you remember that scene in Dumb and Dumber where Jimmy...
No.
No? Where in Dumb and Dumber, Jim Carrey, he's like, I would love to eat her loins with with some fava beans and a nice Chianti. No, that's a great line. There are tons. There are tons. The screaming of the lambs, Clarice, and all that stuff. It rubs the lotion on its skin or else it gets the hose again.
Yeah. Oh my God, that was so creepy.
That was really creepy, yeah.
That was good. Good impression.
Would you F me? You know, I'd F me so hard. You know. I could really audition as Buffalo Bill. I think I'm pretty,
And I have the dodgy wardrobe. What's going on?
You got the wardrobe, I got the voice. Let's combine it. Let's become serial killers together. I don't know. No, edit that out.
Nope. But again, like, the screenplay is really good in reinforcing and letting you know right from the off that Clarice is having, you know, gender struggles in this story with her allies as well. Because... with the first meeting of Crawford, Crawford remembers her giving her one of the seminars, and he says, oh, I remember you giving me a grilling, and I gave you an A, and then Clarice is like, A minus, sir. and it's just like Crawford just seems so sure of himself, and he doesn't even apologize. He just, you know, goes on to the next line, you know, the next... piece of conversation. You know, it's just like Clarice is just really on her own in this with Lecter, and Lecter's like the only one that really respects her in this story. Everyone else is just looking down at her and just just judging her right from the start, whereas Lecter just wants to hear her story, you know.
Well, I think I love like his beginning analysis, because you really don't think he does respect her, but in a kind of strange way he does, and he grows to like her quite a lot through the film. But his first analysis is like, you remind me of a rube. You're only like, you've been trying to hide your like country accent, and he mocks that. And he's like, you're
and
only
your cheap shoes.
And your cheap shoes. You're only one step from poor white trash. And you think, oh, this is scathing. But then he helps her like immediately. And he's like, I don't know. There's this kind of respect that he wants to know more about her. He wants to know more about her life, you know.
Yeah, because that scene, that scene we'll talk about continually, you know, that when he meets Lecter the first time, it's just like there's these incredible like verbal battles that they each have. And there's an interesting bit for me when Hannibal asks her, why do you think Buffalo Bill skins his victims? You know, just out of curiosity for him. And Clarice finishes her answer by saying, most serial killers keep some sort of trophies from the victims. And then Hannibal says, I didn't. And then Clarice says, no, you ate yours.
Yeah.
And then there's a little moment from Lecter. He just looks away for a split second in close up. And it's like he's thinking, oh, is he slightly ashamed at this point? Or is he just, has he let his guard down? Is he slightly admitting that he's lost this verbal battle?
Yeah.
You know, and he, it's like he just did not expect that.
Yeah.
And, you know, for her to be so blunt about, you know, you ate yours.
Yeah. I love how she builds more and more confidence, like, every time they meet. I like the whole quid pro quo scene as well. That was really good.
Yeah.
Whereas he's like, it's tit for tat. You know, you tell me something about Buffalo Bill, I'll tell you something about myself. And I like how she's even reminding him, like, she takes a little control when she's expressed such vulnerability, telling her about how her father died and everything. And he asks another question straight after that, and she's like, quid pro quo.
Yeah, that incredible close-up I was talking about.
Yeah, you know. And she's like, she's reminding him, it's quid pro quo, you've got to tell me something. So, like, she hasn't lost control. You think she has, but she hasn't.
And then later on in the first scene where they meet each other for the first time, as you said, like, Lecter gives her like a pretty damning psychological profile, you know, with the cheap shoes and you're one whatever away from a being cheap white trash. And then she kind of comes back at him by saying, you see a lot, Doctor, but are you strong enough to point that high powered perception at yourself? What about it? Why don't you write down yourself what you see? Or maybe you're afraid to. You know, it's just like, Clarice is fighting back and holding firm. She's not going to let a personal attack slide. And it's like, you know, she's giving some of Lecter's own
medicine. What the hell is Mesodin?
Towards him.
Is that a new street drug?
Yeah. I take it all the time.
You must be taking it now. You're all over the place. Mesodin.
It's the only way I can keep this podcast running, really. Anyway. But yeah, it's just like Lecter is just kind of pissed off at this moment. But at the same time, it's the kind of the turning point for me where Lecter kind of respects her now. Because when Lecter does call her back after Miggs, you know, abuses her sexually, and he says, you know, listen carefully, look deep inside yourself, Clarice, go and seek out Miss Moffat, an old patient of mine. And there's certainly double meaning there, because obviously it's revealed that, you know, the yourself part is the garage that Miss Moffat is in, and it's a test for Clarice to see if
her detective this girl skills, is,
you know, for Lecter. For me, there's definitely double meaning in that, because, you know, the whole look inside yourself thing, for me, it kind of means she has to, like, fight her internal battles, her internal past, you know, her past she has to fight as well through this story and all these other characters that are looking down on her. It's just so well written, so clever. Oh, one that I liked, which is funny, is that when Lecter is in all his restraints at the airport. And
oh, yeah, that was it. Yeah, that's what I was actually going to say. On. Yeah, you nicked my thought. Yeah, like, she's trying to be all compassionate, like, oh, if you have any information on my daughter and all this stuff. And he starts sort of complying. He's like, I think his first name was Lewis and all this stuff. And then he asks her like such a horrible question. It was like, did you breastfeed her? And he's like, yeah. It's like, what on earth is that? Yes, I breastfed her. He goes, did he say like it must have made it tough, made your tits tough or something like that? Made your nipples
tough?
Yeah,
it's pretty horrible.
It's pretty horrible thing to say. And then he's like, they say when a man loses a limb, he can still feel a phantom limb. I wonder when she's dead on the slab, which part of you is going to... It's going to feel it. And you're like, you fucking horrible man. And she's like,
yeah, I mean,
get this thing out of here. Yeah. And then he starts going, yeah.
And then he has the Columbo moment of, oh, Senator, just one more thing. Love your suit.
Yeah. you can tell, like, that whole bit is like, I think the film would have ended much differently had his main psychiatrist, the guy that's in charge, Crawford or whatever. So you can see he gets really jealous and what have you. And when she, and you know, he's not going to be involved in the evaluations of him, and Starling wants him out, and you can tell he doesn't quite like that. But she makes up the offer to Hannibal about, you know, you're going to get once a week, you're going to go get to this island, you can walk around, and he's like, you know, that's actually pretty awesome. And so he leaves her a clue, you know, for her to unravel more of it. And then almost as soon as he does that, it's like he weighs down on it. It's like, there is no deal. She made it up. And then he has a meeting with the senator, because the senator's pissed that, you know, she made up a deal. And the deal the senator has isn't like as good. It's like a less secure facility, which he gets sent to. Still nothing. So you can tell he's really pissy. So that whole comment to her is just him being like really like, why couldn't you have offered me something like that? Do you know what I mean? He's just really sort of... and you can tell even the clues he leaves, obviously as the plot of the film unravels, are completely off. It's to draw them really far away from what's actually
going
on.
So that Sterling can do it.
Yeah, so Sterling can do it, yeah. But, you know, had they not done something like that, maybe he would have left a lot more for Sterling and the FBI and they would have found him a lot quicker. But, you know, I think it was just him being...
He's just toying with them all.
Yeah. Yeah. Because actually that's even what she says, like... Because when she is immediately on the case, she asks her employer, is this about Buffalo Bill? And he says, no. You know, he just needs another psych evaluation. And
he sees through it straight away.
Yeah. But it's kind of funny, because she even goes, like, when he starts giving her clues on Buffalo Bill, she goes back to her employer, why didn't you tell me, you know, that this was actually about Buffalo Bill? And he was like, what was it? Hannibal would have seen straight through that. I couldn't keep you in that loop. It's genuinely, he kind of, yeah. Like, if she actually came there searching for answers, he would have sent her on a wild goose chase. Mm. But because she came there genuinely, he's drip-feeding her.
Well, and, you know, Lecter is just interested in her, interested in her story.
Exactly.
You know, giving her time.
Yeah.
Just because he's interested in why the hell have you sent me a woman, you know?
Yeah. He actually quite likes her, yeah.
Have you got a favourite line, then?
Oh, man, there's so many, you know. Can't stop meeting like this, Clarice. People will think we're in love.
Yeah, that's a good one.
That's a really good one. What was it? You know, the rubs the lotion on its skin. I love that realization moment where Hannibal has said this thing to her many, a few times, about a man covets. He covets what he can, you know, he sees every day. We covet. Yeah, that's it. What do men do? We covet. We covet that which we see every day. And she's not really getting it. But with her study buddy, she works out, oh, crap, the first victim must have lived like next door to him, you know?
Yeah, it's like, had a relationship.
Yeah, it was like he must have actually known her. And so they go to the actual town that the first victim. I think it was the third victim found, but they were like, but it was weighed down with stones. So it was actually the first victim killed canonically, you know? But how she's able to work all that out, it's just really clever. But that's a good line, you know, we covet what we see every day, that's a good line.
Yeah.
There are just so many good lines.
My favourite is right at the end when, you know, where they've solved the case, well, Clarice kills Buffalo Bill and they're, you know, you think the story is just winding down and then Clarice gets a phone call and it's Hannibal on the other end because he's escaped, obviously, and he says, I do wish we could chat longer, but I'm having an old friend for dinner.
Yeah.
Bye.
He has got such a horrible wig on. Oh, my God. It looks so weird.
Yeah. Well, it's a disguise. Yeah. He has a hat, though. It hides it a bit.
Yeah. Such a
yeah, and then
I
then
prefer if he just wore
of...
another human's face. That would have looked better than that wig. Yeah. It's a terrible wig. I think it's one of the most perfect endings with, like, as you said, like, such a badass line. How many films can you think of that end with a memorable line? You know, that yeah. end with a line that's, like, quotable. And
so awesome.
It's just such a great way to end the film. Yeah, I'm having an old friend for dinner. And it's just, it's such a thing Hannibal would say. You're like, you know, that's entirely his character.
I'm going to go solid 9
yeah.
for this one.
Yeah.
For screenplay.
I'll go a 9.
Solid 9?
Maybe 9.3. Fantastic okay. screenplay.
Acting. Yeah. When Clarice hears the news from Clawford that Miggs has died, and, you know, the fact that he swallowed, that Lecter makes Miggs swallow his own tongue, yeah. and, you know, the fact that he was whispering in his ear all night, and then Foster's face is a picture of terror that it's just like, oh shit, I could have been severely affected by him when I met Lecter for the first time. It's just like, oh my God,
yeah.
do not let this guy get in my head.
Yeah.
You know, I've got to play this really carefully. It's just a really great moment from Foster there. Mm. And also from Foster during the post-mortem scene where she finds like the chrysalis of the moth in her mouth, she discovers that, and they turn the body over and you see the skin being cut from her back. And it's just a really incredible performance because she's just trying to concentrate so much on the post-mortem, but at the same time, she's just really trying to keep it together, keep her emotions intact, if you will. Because it's obvious she's never really seen a dead body like this fucked up, you know. It's just really skillful acting of just trying to concentrate on the post-mortem, yet just really trying to keep it together.
Yeah.
I found that really skillful. But one person we haven't really talked about much, really, is Ted Levine, who plays Buffalo Bill.
Oh, man, he is so cool. I mean, he's cool.
I wouldn't say cool.
He wouldn't say cool.
He's really fucked up.
Yeah, he's really fucked up. He's cool. Yeah, he's cool in an evil, evil way. Yeah, I think cool would have been the wrong word to use. Yeah, killing women and making dresses, that's cool. No, I'm joking. It's not cool. Sorry.
Remember that infamous scene where he's just like dancing to music in his lair and he like puts his cock in between his yeah. legs? I just wonder whether that was actually scripted.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. Yeah.
It was not.
No.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I watched a thing with him talking about it. Like, you know, they were talking to the actors and stuff like that. And yeah, he said he made it up and he called it the weenie dance. So he just decided to do it and he did the weenie dance. And they were like, that's okay. Cool. Keep it in. Like, keep your cock in your in your thighs.
Yeah.
I find it... Also, did you notice, like, he had bits where he's doing a very light pitch, effeminate voice? You know, he's broken down and he's asking for help. And it's a lot higher yeah. pitch. He's not speaking like he normally does. It's quite deep voice. And then also when he catches it, it's like... He has put the lotion on his skin. It is very, like, light and effeminate.
Yeah.
But he is really gruff. He's really, you know.
Do you think at some points, do you get the impression that he does have, like, dual personality disorder or something?
I'm not sure if it's, like, as... I don't think he has dual personality disorder. I don't think there's, like, much, like, evidence to support that. I don't think there's really any scene or anybody evaluates him as such. I think it's more like Hannibal Lecter does a little bit where he does just explain what he is. And he says, that he's, you know, he talks something about him being, he wants to be a woman, yeah? And she goes, well, transvestites are not very violent, do you know what I mean? They're quite passive.
Yeah, yeah.
So she didn't really buy that. And he goes, no, but he believes he is a transsexual. You know, it's not so much that he wants to be a woman, it's he really hates himself, that he just wants to be something other, and he's convinced that, you know, he should be a woman. So I think that's kind of... I don't know how you get from that to, I want to make a pretty dress made of human skin. I don't think that makes you look more like a woman. That makes you look like a fruitcake. But maybe it's kind of like he wants to... It's not so much as making it a dress, but like a new body. Because nobody will actually change his sex. Like, I think...
Well, they say that he was turned down.
Yeah. She said
sex realignment.
Yeah.
Or
he said that's where you should look. People... turned down by one person turned down by every sexual maybe they were like, no, we can't do that, we can't do a sex change for you because you've got too many problems, you know, Yeah, and I think maybe that's his way of compensating for it. If I can't physically change myself, I will wear a woman. I will wear a woman body. Mm. Yeah.
I was just thinking about the gender politics here. I don't think it's offensive to like transgender people, because obviously the transgender is very much in the forefront of society now, which is great. But I think this film still holds up in the... It's not offensive, I don't think.
Well, none of the characters like constantly comment it or like make a big deal about trans people. And especially, you know, that line where I think it does save it in that point of view, where she does, her assessment of it is trans people wouldn't really do this, and then it's like, okay, so he doesn't stand for trans people, he's a freaking lunatic. Just like if you had a film about Ted Bundy who like raped and ate women, or you have a character that does that, that doesn't mean like men do that, you know, like I like women, you like women, that doesn't mean like we do it. It's just that guy's a fruitcake, he doesn't represent all trans,
definitely.
Buffalo Bill doesn't represent all trans, just as, you know, Ted Bundy doesn't represent all men or whatever.
Mm. Going back to Anthony Hopkins, as you always should do.
Every conversation should end with Anthony Hopkins. Doesn't matter what it is.
Yeah. But one of my favorite scenes from him is when Lecter is like picking the handcuffs and attacks the two cops in the cage. The only time for me Hopkins becomes aggressive and changes his like demeanor is when, you know, his calm demeanor is when he's like bites one of the cops' faces and he goes a bit crazy there. But when he's like beating the guy in the head and like using the baton to hit the other one, it's just got such a calm and controlled sense of his character and his performance. It's just, you know, it's kind of so restrained, and you have this sense of calmness that this is just nothing. Do you know what I mean?
It's not done out of passion,
frantic
or anger,
or anything.
Yeah. No, he's very level.
It's just what he likes doing. Yeah. You know, it's just so controlled. And
well, after he kills that guy, then he starts moving his hand to the opera music that's going on.
Yeah, so like I think all his movements are really nice and slow and fluid. Even before that scene when he meets Clarice, everything's so smooth and fluid and slow and centered, and you get this just incredible, creepy, uncomfortable feeling in all his movements and his dialogue and his performance in general. The attack on those two cops just encapsulates that to the fore, you know. It's quite incredible. My best performance is Anthony Hopkins, there's no doubt about it for me. I'm guessing yours is Anthony Hopkins as well.
Oh yeah, yeah, 100%. Yeah, he steals the show. It's his movie. This is why. Yeah.
I mean, he's not even in it that much, really.
It's strange, but he does leave like such a tremendous impact on the film. I just can't imagine it without him in it. And I do think you're right. I think if you kind of tally it up, maybe he's in there. I don't know, somebody must have tallied up the screen time. Like, certainly he's not in it anywhere near as much as...
like 30 minutes or something?
It might be less than that. It might be less than that, maybe 15 minutes, I don't know. And, you know, it's definitely, Jodie Foster's film. But I don't know, he just leaves just such a tremendous impact.
So, score for me, I mean, this... I think, you know, Ted Levine and Jodie Foster as well are on top of their game, and all the other characters are like Scott Glenn, there you go. And Scott Glenn, he's pretty incredible as well, if I'm honest. So I think acting wise, it's extraordinary. And Foster and Hopkins both won an Oscar for this film. Mm. So I'm going to go 9.6 for acting.
Yeah.
What about you?
I'll go 9.4.
Cool. Let's add up the scores for acting and see where Silence of the Lambs is. It's pretty high. It's 55.8.
Wow.
So Silence of the Lambs wins this one over Contact, which scored 51.8. So it's very high. That score, actually, it could be top. I'm not quite sure, but I need to check.
has it eaten the competition? Because it's Hannibal. He eats everything.
Yes.
Shut up. Crickets.
Yep, Silence of the Lambs is top.
Is it really?
Now.
Wow, that's crazy.
55.8, and Get Out is second now with 55. Contact lands at joint 8th place with Do the Right Thing. So that's it for this week. Next week, we'll be talking Mads Mikkelsen films as Chaos Walking, hopefully, fingers crossed, will be out in cinemas, but if not, they'll certainly either push it back or to put it out on VOD. And Mads Mikkelsen plays the villain in that film, so you know he made his name as a villain in Casino Royale. So it'd be really interesting to see what we pick for Mads Mikkelsen, one of really interesting actors right now.
Yeah, the only person to hit James Bond repeatedly in the bollocks. So it's an interesting.
This is correct. continues the theme of genitalia on this podcast.
Exactly. Genitalia versus film.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Film versus balls.
Thanks again, Boaz. Pleasure as always. Bye.
Bye.
That's it for this week's pod. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. If you would like to find out more about the podcast or suggest future topics for us to discuss related to upcoming releases, let us know on Instagram at Film vs. Film Podcast or on Twitter at FVF_podcast. Remember, please subscribe. Pod signing off. Thank you.